All right, welcome to episode 632 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In today's podcast, we're going to be continuing the series on travel medicine. This is going to be part B. Again, if you missed part A, I strongly encourage you to go back and listen to it. It is a very high-yield podcast, and I know it may be titled Travel Medicine, but it's not just travel medicine I discussed there. I made a lot of very useful integrations that I think you're going to find to be helpful for your exams. All right, let's jump right into it. So what if they give you a question about a patient? They tell you that this patient, traveled, he can even be traveled within the U.S. actually, or traveled outside the U.S. Remember, you're taking the U.S. MLE exams. And, you know, over the past 5 days, the patient has been having like very high fevers, and the fevers have worsened over the course of the week. You know, they tell you that the person has been having that on Monday, their temperature was like 101. On Tuesday was 102, Wednesday was 103 point something. You just have this progressive increase in the person's temperature over time. And then they tell you that you see these faint macules on the person's lower abdomen. And then, you know, they give you that, the current vital signs, you see the person's temperature is 104. And you notice that this person's heart rate is 45. Right? The person's heart rate is 45. And they tell you that the person has not had any bowel movement over the last 2 days. If you see something like this, and it's probably going to be in a child on your exams, what should you be thinking about? I'd hope you're thinking about typhoid fever, right? So this child has infection with Salmonella typhi, right? And the thing is, again, just like I did in the previous podcast, there are so many different integrations they can make with this stuff on your exams, right? So like, for example, they can ask you, like, how did this person acquire this infection? Well, obviously, it's going to be by way of a fecal-oral transmission, right? Fecal-oral transmission. You consume contaminated food, you consume contaminated water, you're going to increase your risk of contracting a Salmonella, right? And the thing is, Salmonella, what kind of, if it were to cause diarrhea, what kind of diarrhea would it cause? It's actually going to cause bloody diarrhea, right? It's going to cause bloody diarrhea, right? Because it's an invasive organism, right? So basically what it does is, there's these M cells, I believe they're called microfold cells, that we find in the GI tract, especially in the terminal ileum, right? Like in the terminal ileum area, we find them in Peyer's patches, right? So it invades those cells, right? It survives in those cells. I believe those cells are a kind of macrophage, right? And then from there, it gets into the bloodstream, right? And then once it gets into the bloodstream, it loves the reticuloendothelial system. It just absolutely loves your reticuloendothelial system. What do I mean by reticuloendothelial system? And this is something you want to lock down in your mind for your exams. This is a term that keeps coming up. And the thing is, when you understand this term, it's going to make certain things that you previously memorized make sense to you. Right? So what's the reticuloendothelial system? It basically includes essentially like four things: liver, spleen, bone marrow, and gallbladder, right? Liver, spleen, bone marrow, and gallbladder, right? Bone marrow and gallbladder, right? So the thing is, if this thing likes to invade these organs, it shouldn't come as a big surprise that the person may have hepatosplenomegaly. Right? They may have hepatosplenomegaly, right? And the thing is, I know many people have memorized Salmonella. Salmonella causes bloody diarrhea. Salmonella causes bloody diarrhea. That's true. It does cause bloody diarrhea. But the thing is, typically, you're going to have constipation to start, right? That's why if you notice, I led in the question by saying that, hey, this person hasn't had a bowel movement for like 2 days, right? So just be careful about that. The USMLEs, they know what you have memorized. Again, these people are not stupid. It's not like they just live under a rock in their MBME headquarters and they don't have any idea of what people are learning. No, they do have ideas of what people are learning. So just be careful about that, right? Constipation is typically more common than diarrhea in the early course of Salmonella infection. In the early course of Salmonella infection, right? And, you know, again, typically, how do you diagnose this? You're going to do a blood culture, especially if they've had symptoms for just like 7 days or less. You're going to go ahead and do a blood culture. Although you can also, you know, after like 7 days or thereabouts, you should probably go ahead and do a stool culture or a urine culture, right? A stool culture or urine culture. But if you don't see an answer choice that says blood culture, you know, again, blood cultures are going to be it within like the first few days, you know, 5 to 7 days. But after that, you want to consider a stool or urine culture. But if you don't see an answer that says blood culture or an answer that says stool or urine culture, can I tell you one thing you can do? Bone marrow culture, right? Bone marrow culture. Bone marrow culture is extremely helpful if you really need to make the diagnosis of Salmonella, you know, some salmonellosis, right? Because again, remember, it seeds to the reticuloendothelial system. So if you check the bone marrow, you're going to find it there. You're going to find it there, right? And how do you treat it? Well, you're going to treat it typically with, you can do like a fluoroquinolone, right? You can do a fluoroquinolone, or you can use ceftriaxone, right? But again, remember, fluoroquinolones, there's a lot of resistance. It can explode your Achilles. It can prolong your QT interval. It can cause a bunch of problems, right? So you may want to consider a macrolide like azithromycin. Azithromycin is a good idea when a person has salmonella, right? And it's resistant to a fluoroquinolone, or you don't want to give that child a fluoroquinolone, right? And again, remember, the USML is these days about 5% or more of your exam questions have this preventive medicine bent. Right? So you need to consider that, hey, how could you have prevented this from happening in this person that traveled? Well, you could have given one of two vaccines. And I believe I highlighted that in the previous podcast. You could either have given the oral vaccine or the injectable vaccine, right? The oral vaccine is live attenuated. It is live attenuated, right? But again, remember, in the previous podcast, I talked about some populations where it may not be smart to give a live attenuated vaccine. So if you cannot give the oral live attenuated form, you can give the injectable form. The injectable form is a polysaccharide, right? And it's safe in people that are immunocompromised, right? In fact, the injectable form, you only have to give one dose versus the oral form, they have to give four doses, right? Four doses, right? And again, the vaccines have roughly equal efficacy, right? So it's just something you want to keep at the back of your mind for your exams. And then what is one amazing thing our friends at the MBMEs can test? They can say, hey, you know, this person traveled, you know, they have the faint colored macules on their abdomen, right? Those are the raw spots I kind of referenced in the question. Those are the raw spots. And you may notice, right, you know, as I develop this new vignette, right, the person had a high fever, but they had bradycardia, right? That's kind of strange. That's kind of strange. Typically, when people have fevers, they tend to have tachycardias with it, right? Even like a mom, when a mom is pregnant and she has a fever, the fetal heart rate is typically going to be over 160, right? Maternal fever has a strong association with fetal tachycardia, right? So it's kind of weird when you see a person that has this thing called a pulse temperature dissociation, right? Pulse temperature dissociation. Your pulse and your temperature should be associated. As your pulse rises, your temperature should rise. But so it's kind of bizarre, like your pulse is rising and your temperature is rising and your pulse is falling. That's a dissociation, right? Dissociations in medicine just mean that, hey, there are two things that are supposed to go in tandem and they don't seem to be going in tandem, right? Your temperature is going up, your pulse should go up. But one is going up, the other is coming down. That's a pulse temperature dissociation. That's very common with salmonella. Right, another dissociation you may have heard of is albuminocytologic dissociation that we see in Guillain-Barré, right? Typically, the normal association is as you see an increase in CSF protein, you typically see an increase in cells, like inflammatory cells within the CSF. But in Guillain-Barré syndrome, you see an increase in protein, but you don't see a commensurate increase in cells. That's a dissociation. Right? So again, coming back to typhoid, right? So in typhoid, right, they have the pulse temperature dissociation, they have the raw spots, right? Those faint, you know, salmon-colored macules you're going to see on the lower abdomen, on the trunk, right? It doesn't have to be lower abdomen, it can also be on the upper abdomen. But again, that's not you don't always find it. In fact, you probably find it in like less than a third of people that have salmonella, right? And then they tell you that, you know, this person has been having bloody diarrhea for the past like, you know, few days, but that over the last 3 hours, the person has been complaining of severe worsening abdominal pain. The person's fever is higher, right? And you notice that the person has like rebound or guarding on a physical exam. When you see something like that, what's going on? They've exploded their GI tracts. They've literally exploded their GI tracts, right? And they may ask you which of the following is the most appropriate next best step in management. I'd really hope you're picking the answer that talks about exploratory laparotomy. I bet you never thought that there would be a question on salmonella on your exams where exploratory laparotomy is the next step. Well, you've just heard one from this podcast, right? So guys, please, like, this stuff is actually pretty high yield to know for your exams. Again, the USMLEs, they love to integrate, you know, because they know that all of you have memorized, penetrating trauma to the abdomen, X-lap, free air under the diaphragm, X-lap, right? Signs of peritonitis, X-lap. Right? So again, how do they test it these days? They can just give you a person that has something that can lead to bowel rupture, right? So like, for example, if a person has salmonella, right? Again, salmonella is pretty invasive. That's why it causes bloody diarrhea. It literally invades your intestinal mucosa. When you are an invasive bug, right? When you're an invasive bug, you tend to cause bloody diarrhea. When you are not an invasive bug, you tend to not cause bloody diarrhea, right? So this, they invade, so they cause bloody diarrhea. But all that invasion, right, can ultimately lead to intestinal perforation. And this is something that tends to happen when you've had your symptoms for like 2 weeks, 3 weeks, or stuff like that, right? So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient? And they tell you that this patient, you know, again, visited some foreign country, right? But again, you don't have to visit a foreign country to have travel medicine problems. You could also have traveled within the US, right? And you're told that this person, they say that, you know, that for the last, how do I put this? I want to frame this in a way that will make it make sense for you. I want to frame this in a way that will make it make sense for you. Let's see. So what if they tell you that a person traveled, right? And that for the last 4 or 5 days, you know, they've been having fevers, you know, feeling nauseous, they have jaundice, right? But the person is not an IV drug user. The person is not immunocompromised. The person doesn't have HIV, right? And the person's LFTs are elevated. And to be honest with you, they just give you a travel history or like, oh, you just ate a bunch of foods from different vendors, blah, 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 blah. Right? When you see something like that, what should you be thinking about on your exams? I would really hope you're thinking about Hep A infection, right? I'd really hope you're thinking about what? Hepatitis A infection. Again, it is something that is pretty high yield to know for purposes of your exams, right? And just one thing I want to mention. So, because the USMLEs, they're not very big on giving people a lot of clues. Again, typically they give you a decent number of clues, but sometimes they can write these non-specific questions where they don't give you many clues, but they still magically expect you to arrive at the right answer, right? So the thing is, you see a lot of food exposure, a lot of traveling, high LFTs, jaundice, right? You know, some right upper quadrant pain. You really want to be thinking about, hepatitis A, right? And the thing is, sometimes on your exams, instead of putting Hep A as the answer, they'll put Picorna virus as the answer. Again, you've heard me say this on this podcast many times about the concept of a derivative, right? So the USMLEs, again, they know many of you probably can recognize Hep A. So how can you just create a new Hep A question? Well, one of the ways you can create a new Hep A question is just keep the same vignette you've always used in previous years, right? But just switch up the answer. Why put Hep A when you can just put an alternate name for Hep A, like Picorna virus? Right, it's a Picorna, P-I-C-O-R-N-A, Picorna virus, right? Or why put yellow fever as an answer when you can put flavivirus as an answer, right? Why put, let's see, what's another common one they love to tease people with on exams? Why put parvovirus B19 on your exams where you can put single-stranded DNA virus on your test? So guys, do you see why you need to know the classifications of these organisms? Yeah, that's why you need to know those, right? Because those are common sources of derivatives on your exams. Those are common sources of what? Of derivatives on your exams, right? So just kind of keep that at the back of your mind for your test, right? So again, going back to Hep A, right? So again, you know, typically it's going to be a person that traveled, you know, had food exposure like a month ago, right? You know, so typically the incubation period is about a month, right? About a month. And then the person is going to have like fevers, you know, anorexia, you know, malaise, jaundice, you know, all that stuff, right? Their LFTs will be elevated, right? And the thing is, typically, as you get older, you tend to have more severe infection. This is one of those strange things. You're like, ooh, kids tend to have more severe infection. No, not for Hep A. For Hep A, things are kind of different. In fact, many times, kids that have Hep A infection, they tend to be asymptomatic. But as you get older, the severity tends to increase, right? The severity tends to increase, right? And then our friends at the MBMEs, this is something I was actually kind of almost like preaching like a sermon in one of the classes I thought recently that, hey, prognosis is a big thing on the USMLE exams. Right, is a big thing on the USMLE exam. So what can they do with prognosis here? Well, we know that most people that have Hep A can recover, right? Most people recover and it's not a big deal. But one thing our friends at the MBMEs love to do is, what if you, they can give you a question about a person that has Hep A infection, right? And the person has a history of, you know, like Hep C, or the person has a history of some kind of liver disease or whatever, right? And then they will ask, which of the following factors in the patient's medical history most increases the risk of developing a fulminant hepatitis. Well, you want to maybe go ahead and pick the answer that talks about the liver disease, the pre-existing liver disease that the patient has, right? Again, this is something the US MLEs love to do, right? So they'll usually give you many things in the person's medical history. The person will have like some kind of liver disease. The person will have high blood pressure, maybe heart failure, whatever, right? If a person has pre-existing liver disease, that is one of the biggest determinants of their prognosis if they have an acute Hep A infection, okay? And remember, Hep A does not cause chronic infection. It causes an acute infection, right? So like typically, if you want to diagnose Hep A, just check the anti-HAV IgM, right? If it's the IgM that's positive, it tells you that it's an acute infection. If it's the IgG that is positive, it means that this person has probably had a past infection, right? Or they got a vaccine against Hep A, because there is in fact a Hep A vaccine. There is in fact a Hep A vaccine, right? So you may wonder, like, Divine, why is it that IgM indicates an acute infection? Well, think about this. What is the first antibody you make to any infection? It's going to be IgM, right? Literally by default, the first antibody your immune system makes to any infection is IgM. And then after that, this process called class switching is going to happen. Isotype switching is going to happen. And then you're going to go from IgM to IgG or to IgA or to IgE. Okay? You may again be wondering, like, Divine, why? Tell me why. Why is IgM made first? Well, the thing is, when your body is making antibodies, the first part of the genome that it can tap into, that it can access, is literally the IgM part of your genome. Right? It literally has no access to the other parts, right? So it has to work with what it has current access to. That's why IgM is the first antibody that's made. Now, there's more genetic underpinnings there, but that's kind of beyond the scope of this podcast. So I'm going to move on from that, right? And again, preventive medicine is a big thing on the exams, right? So they can ask you, oh, which of the following measures would have decreased this person's risk of infection? Well, the person could have gotten the vaccine, right? The person could literally have gotten the vaccine. Right? Remember, you get the vaccine as two doses, right? And it's extremely effective, right? You get it as a child, right? You get it in two doses. You give the first dose, and then like 6 to 12 months later, you give the second dose. It's extremely effective. The immunity stays for a pretty long period of time. So it's just something you want to keep at the back of your mind for your exams, right? But one thing our friends at the MBMEs can also do is they can ask you about post-exposure prophylaxis, actually, for Hep A. This is one of those things that you almost never find in any resource, but it's actually very, very high yield to know for your exams. It's actually what? Very, very high yield to know for your exams, right? So they can ask you, like, you know, let's say there's been an outbreak, or you're aware that a person was exposed to Hep A recently, right? Especially within, like, the past, like, 2 weeks, right? After, like, 2 weeks, all bets are kind of off. And then they ask you, you know, which of the following is the most appropriate next best step in management? In that case, go ahead and give the person the Hep A vaccine, right? In general, post-exposure prophylaxis, when you've been exposed to Hep A, especially if you're asymptomatic, is for you to get the Hep A vaccine, okay? It's for you to get the Hep A vaccine, right? But if a person is immunocompromised, right, or let's say the person has some kind of chronic liver disease, let's say they have cirrhosis, then you don't just give the vaccine alone. You can actually give the vaccine plus the immune globulin, plus Hep A immune globulin, right? And also, that's something we may do in people that are over age 40. But generally, people that are even over age 40, doesn't matter. You can still give them the vaccine alone. That's fine. That's fine, okay? But please do not forget this for purposes of your exams, right? For most people, just give them the Hep A vaccine, right? That's fine. But if the person is immunocompromised or they have chronic liver disease, then you need to try to give them not just the vaccine, you also need to give them the immune globulin, right? So basically, you're giving them active immunity and passive immunity, right? So again, our friends at the MBMEs, they know some people may have memorized, the vaccine plus immune globulin. So what's another way they can literally word the exact same thing on your exams? They can word the exact same thing by putting an answer that says active immunity alone, passive immunity alone. Active plus passive immunity, right? So obviously, if a person is getting the vaccine alone, they're only getting active immunity. But if the person is getting the vaccine and the immune globulin, you're getting not just active immunity alone, but they're also getting passive immunity. All right. So keep that at the back of your mind. Remember, fecal oral transmission, right? And you can also get person-to-person spread, right? Person-to-person spread. That's why we do this thing called post-exposure prophylaxis, right? And again, you consume contaminated food, contaminated water, you're going to get in trouble. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient? And this patient has, you know, fevers, you know, really nasty headache, right? And they tell you that, you know, that they were bitten and they have like this, you know, that they went to a foreign country and they were, in fact, like they were bitten by a dog, right? But they thought nothing of it. But now this person has been having fevers, headaches. This person has been having a paresthesias where they were bitten, right? And then they tell you that this patient for the last 4 days has not taken a shower, right? For the last 4 days hasn't taken a shower, right? And this person has been very, you know, having like very hyperactive symptoms, has been having a lot of hallucinations. When you see something like this, what should you be thinking about? I'd hope you're thinking about rabies, right? I hope you're thinking about rabies, right? Our friends at the MBMEs, one time honor thing they love to do is to test rabies in the context of travel medicine on your exams, right? So typically, how do you get rabies? Well, you're going to get it from a bite or a scratch, right? So they may not use the word dog bite. They may use the term that the person was just scratched by some animal, right? So a dog bite or a dog scratch, just be mindful of that, right? From an infected animal, you know, a dog, right? Literally, like, dogs are the most common vectors for rabies globally. They're literally the most common vectors, right? The virus is in the saliva of that dog, right? The virus is in the saliva of that dog. So when the dog bites or scratches you, then you're going to acquire said virus, right? And this can happen in, you know, African countries, Asian countries. But again, it can also happen within the US. It's not like the US is like immune to rabies, just FYI, right? So typically, how do these people progress over time? Well, they usually start off with like fevers, headaches, right? The place where they were bitten or scratched, they have paresthesias there, right? But then over time, they start having things like hydrophobia, a fear of water. Right? Aerophobia, a fear of air, right? They are very hyperactive. They're having these hallucinations, right? In fact, sometimes that is called like a furious rabies. I like to call, you know, and the name is very descriptive, furious. Think about if Divine is furious with you, it means very angry, right? So a person is like, right? So furious rabies, right? But over time, you know, it then progresses to paralysis. Right, they start having like a like an ascending paralysis that actually looks a lot like Guillain-Barré syndrome, right? And then over time they're gonna die, basically, right? The final common pathway, once you generally become symptomatic of rabies, you're probably gonna die. Once you start having symptoms, you're probably gonna die. The mortality is like 100%. Rabies is one of those things you don't mess around with, right? If not, the person is gonna die. Person is gonna die, right? So once they start having the hydrophobia, aerophobia, and stuff, kind of all bets are off. You know, you can do ICU care or whatever, but they're probably gonna die. So, how do you treat rabies? It is super high yield. Ugh, man, our friends at the MBMEs, it's just amazing how diverse they can be with the questions they test, right? So they can literally, let me give you like the different variants of questions you may see on your exams with rabies. Number one, they can give you a question about a person that was just bitten by a dog like a few minutes ago or a few hours ago, right? And the dog status is literally not known. And then they ask you, which of the following represents the most appropriate next best step in management? And they will give you an answer that says to give the tetanus vaccine. They'll give you an answer that says to give the rabies vaccine. They'll give you an answer that says to give the rabies vaccine and the immune globulin. I'm going to talk about all these things. And then they give you an answer that says to irrigate the wound with soap and water. What answer should you pick? Please, guys, pick the answer that talks about irrigating the wound with soap and water. That's literally the first thing you should do. That is a phenomenal way to do source control, right? So if a person has like a fresh wound, irrigate that wound with soap and water. That's a very smart thing to do, right? Thoroughly wash that wound where the person was bitten or scratched with soap and water. Do it for about 15 minutes, right? In fact, it literally reduces your risk of the rabies progressing by like 80 to 90%. That's probably one of the most important interventions you can do for those people. So wash for about 15 minutes. You're literally washing the rabies out, right? That's an amazing way to do source control, right? And then what else should you do? Well, the thing is, if a person has never been vaccinated against rabies or you don't know their vaccine status, then the thing you want to do is you want to give them the immune globulin and the vaccine. Okay, you want to give them the immune globulin and the vaccine, right? So their vaccine status is unknown. or, you know, they've been unvaccinated, give them the immune globulin and the vaccine. And the place you give the immune globulin matters. You want to give the immune globulin directly into the wound, right? Infiltrates the wound with the immune globulin. Why in the world are you going to do that? Well, the reason you're going to do that is because like the rabies virus is within that wound. That's why the earlier you give it, the better. It's literally within that wound, right? So if you give the immune globulin will literally bind up the virus. That's very helpful, right? But then remember, give the vaccine elsewhere. Please do not give the vaccine. Please, thou shalt not give the vaccine at the same place where you give the immune globulin. If not, that vaccine ain't gonna work. Why? Because the vaccine will literally be bound up by the immune globulin, right? So literally give the vaccine at a distant intramuscular site. Don't give it at the same site where you give the person the immune globulin. Just something you want to keep at the back of your mind, right? And then, and the vaccine is like 4 doses, but you don't need to worry about that for your test, right? But if you've been, well, maybe you need to worry about that for your test actually, right? But if you've been previously vaccinated, right? Let's say you've gotten the vaccine against rabies, then you don't need the immune globulin. All you need to do is just give the vaccine. Give 2 doses of the vaccine and that's it, right? That's it. Now, what if a person, so we've talked about post-exposure. What if it's like, man, I'm kind of putting myself in a high-risk situation. You know, I have a high risk of getting rabies. What can I do so that I don't develop problems in the first place? On your exams, go ahead and give those people the vaccines, right? Go ahead and give those people the vaccines, right? Go ahead and give those people the vaccines, right? Give them the vaccine, right? And the good thing is, once a person gets the vaccine, then post-exposure prophylaxis is just going to be the vaccine. Again, remember, please, don't make the Hep B mistake, right? What do I mean by the Hep B mistake, right? Obviously, if you've gotten the Hep B vaccine, then if you're exposed to Hep B like needle stick, you don't need any kind of post-exposure prophylaxis. You don't need the immune globulin, you don't need the Hep B vaccine. But that does not necessarily work with rabies, right? That literally does not necessarily work with rabies, right? Rabies, if you've been vaccinated and you're exposed to an animal, you know, bitten, scratched or whatever, you still need to get the vaccine only as the post-exposure prophylaxis, right? So again, the pre-exposure prophylaxis is to get the vaccine. Literally, get the vaccine, right? So you may be wondering, Divine, what kinds of patients may I see on the exams that should get the rabies vaccine as pre-exposure prophylaxis? Consider a person that works with animals, a veterinarian, right? A person that works with animals, they should probably get the vaccine, right? That can be a question on your exams, right? They give you a question about a person that is, starting veterinary medicine school, right? And they say, oh, which of the following, you know, they can literally make a vaccination question out of a person studying vet med school, right? In that case, person should get the rabies vaccine. Person should get the rabies vaccine, right? And also, if you're going to a place, if you're traveling to a place where rabies is endemic, yeah, you should also get the vaccine, right? Or you're going on an adventure. You're going to be exploring a lot of caves, right? You're going spelunking. You should probably go ahead and take the rabies vaccine. Go ahead and take the rabies vaccine. All right. So I think those are all the things I think I want to say about rabies. Those are all the things I think I want to say about rabies. I just want to give a few more quick hits on some minor things that pop up in travel medicine, and then we'll go ahead and I think I want to try to see if I can compress everything else into this one podcast, right? But don't forget on your exams, again, this maybe pops up every few years, right? Pretty much everybody gets it wrong. But again, you don't have to join those people to get it wrong if you just kind of pay attention, right? But again, you know, they can give you a question about a person that visits rural Asia. So how's this going to present on your exams? It's going to be a person that visited or visits rural Asia, right? So like rural India, rural Japan, right? Or you see Papua New Guinea. If you see Papua New Guinea, person that visited like a Papua New Guinea or like a rural part of Papua New Guinea, right? Papua is P-A-P-U-A. New is new, you know, N-E-W. And then Guinea, G-U-I-N-E-A, right? So a person visited there, right? And then they've been having fevers, You know, they've been having headaches, altered mental status, seizures, right? They even have like signs of Parkinsonism, right? They have like a paucity of movement and all those things. You want to think about Japanese encephalitis. You want to think about Japanese encephalitis, right? That's the way they're going to present it on your exams, right? And remember, it's carried by the Culex mosquito, right? Not so cute after all, right? So Culex, C-U-L-E-X, the Culex mosquito, right? And especially like if they tell you that the person went to a rural area where a lot of rice is grown. A lot of rice is grown. Think about Japanese encephalitis, right? Because it likes to breed in these rice paddies. It's just one of those strange things you want to know for your exams, right? Or let's say the person had a lot of exposure to pigs, because pigs are a big time reservoir of this, right? Keep that at the back of your mind for exams. Pigs, birds, think about this, right? And this is another flavivirus, right? Kind of like, what's the other thing I've discussed today that's a flavivirus? Yellow virus, right? Yellow virus, right? So this bug is a flavivirus, right? And it's neurotropic. It likes to go to the brain. Why? Because it literally can cross the blood-brain barrier. Crosses the blood-brain barrier, infects, inflames your neurons, right? And then the person has encephalitis, right? That's why they have like altered mental status. They have seizures and things of that nature, right? Things of that nature, right? And sometimes on your exams, they can ask you which of the following is the most common clinical presentation of Japanese encephalitis. Most people are going to be asymptomatic. They're not going to have any symptoms. But some people can have very, very, very nasty encephalitis, right? Very, very nasty encephalitis, right? Very, very nasty encephalitis. And once a person has encephalitis, their risk of dying is almost like one third, right? Their risk of dying is almost like one third, right? And even if those people survive, many of them are going to have like permanent neurologic damage. Right? And the way you're going to diagnose this is just look for the IgM, again, acute infection, right? IgM in like the CSF or in the serum. You can even do a PCR of these fluids, right? And then there's no, it's a virus. There's not much in the way of treatment that's available, right? There's literally not much in the way of treatment available. But the vaccine, you can give an inactivated vaccine, right? So again, if a person is visiting Papua New Guinea, or a person is visiting a rural Asian country, right? Or a person is visiting a place where they're going to be exposed to a lot of pigs, again, especially in a rural Asian country, or a place where a lot of rice is grown in a rural Asian country, those people should get the Japanese encephalitis vaccine, right? It's an inactivated vaccine. All right. So what are some other high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind with travel medicine? Well, you see a person that travels to Egypt or sub-Saharan Africa, right? Sub-Saharan Africa, or travels to the Middle East, right? And then you notice that the person has been having fevers, urticaria, right? They have hepatosplenomegaly, right? You notice that they have like, they may have hematuria, right? And you notice that their eosinophil count is really, 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 really high. That's a parasite. That's schistosomiasis, right? That's schistosoma hematobium, right? It's going to be a person that was exposed to water. You know, they swam in the Nile, or they swam in some body of water, right? And again, they know that everybody has memorized the Egypt Association, right? They know that everybody has memorized the Egypt Association. So since they know that, ooh, many people have memorized the Egypt Association, do you know what they do these days on the exams? They test other countries, right? They test sub-Saharan Africa, right? Sub-Saharan Africa are countries like Nigeria, like Ghana. So guys, guess what? You can get schistosomiasis traveling to those countries. You can get it going to the Middle East, going to like Libya, Qatar, right? Going to Saudi Arabia. These are all countries where you can absolutely get that problem from. So just kind of keep that at the back of your mind for exams, right? And again, how are you going to get this problem? By swimming in fresh water, right? That contains the Cercariae, right? The Cercariae is spelled as C-E-R-C-A-R, right? I-A-E, Cercariae, right? So again, keep that in mind, right? From snails, right? I don't know if I'd ever travel to a foreign country and swim in the water. At least, maybe a pool, but it's just a lot of things that are in pools, man. And, you know, just something to keep in mind, right? And remember, schistosoma has two major species you should worry about for your exams, right? So there's schistosoma hematobium. Hema, right? Red. Tobium, right? So this thing kind of causes, bladder infection, right? It goes after the bladder. It goes into the venous plexus of the bladder. So it literally attacks the blood vessels that feed the bladder, that drain the bladder, the venous plexus, right? So they can have hematuria, they can have like blood, you know, fibrosis of the bladder. It can cause squamous cell cancer of the bladder, right? Be careful, guys. Squamous cell cancer of the bladder. Oh, man, the USMLEs, there's just so many ways they can get people. Guys, squamous cell cancer of the bladder is not the same thing as transitional cell cancer of the bladder. It's not the same thing. Squamous cell cancer of the bladder, right? Most bladder cancers are transitional cell. If you see a person that has squamous cell cancer of the bladder, it's probably a schistosomiasis question on your exams. All right. And then, what's the other species of schistosoma you should know for your exams? Well, think of Schistosoma mansoni or Schistosoma japonicum, right? These ones tend to go after the intestines and the liver, right? So they lay their eggs. Those eggs get trapped in the portal circulation. You form a lot of granulomas. They can start fibrosing their liver. They can develop cirrhosis. They can have portal hypertension, right? So again, how is this going to present clinically on your exams? Again, person is going to, like, you know, like, 2 weeks up to 2 months, right? So I like the 2 and 2 rule, right? 2 weeks to up to 2 months after you've been exposed, right? You have fever, a lot of urticaria, a lot of eosinophils because it's a parasite, right? And eosinophils help us deal with parasites. And remember, eosinophils, they have this protein called major basic protein that is very good for helping us kind of deal with parasites. It's one of those strange factoids that's basic science-y that they love to put on step one, step two, and step three, right? Major basic protein, right? And it's a, you know, it's pretty much a type 3 hypersensitivity reaction. Right. And then, you know, so that's how it's going to present acutely. But chronically, right, you're not going to get cancer like within a month of getting infected with schistosoma hematobium. Right. That makes no sense. Right. That literally makes no sense. No, it's going to be months to years later. Right. Person can, you know, again, like the Schistosoma mansoni or japonicum, you can have fibrosis of your intestines, of your liver, right? They can get cirrhosis, they can develop portal hypertension, right? They can have hepatosplenomegaly. They can, believe it or not, they can actually give you esophageal varices. Oh my goodness. Esophageal varices as a question in a person that has schistosomiasis. Schistosoma mansoni or japonicum. So they can give you a question about a person that has a remote history. It's going to be that, oh, they traveled to Egypt like 10 years ago and, you know, they had like some abdominal pain when they came back, you know, but they never followed up with a physician. And this is like 10 years later and now they've been coughing up blood, right? They've been having right upper quadrant pain. They've developed ascites. That's portal hypertension because of the intestinal and hepatic fibrosis that we see from Schistosoma mansoni or Schistosoma japonicum. Schistosoma mansoni or Schistosoma japonicum, right? And again, remember from the hematobium end of the spectrum, right? They can have hematuria, they can have bladder cancer and all those things, right? And again, how do you diagnose this? Again, just look for the ova in the stool. Look for the ova in the stool. But that's for mansoni or japonicum. If you want to find Schistosoma hematobium, you should check the urine. And again, you may be like, oh, Divine, this is so hard to memorize. Well, guess what? It's going to be hard to memorize if you pay no attention to just basic common sense and pathophysiology. What do I mean by basic common sense and pathophysiology? What did I say so far about the parts of the body that are infected by Schistosoma mansoni or japonicum? What did I say? I said that they infect your GI tract and your liver. So things from the liver or GI tract, where are you going to find them? You're going to find them in the stool, guys. You're going to find them in the stool. So look for the ova in the stool. But where does Schistosoma hematobium go to? It goes to your liver. Yeah, it does go to your liver. I mean, sorry, to your bladder. What did I just say? It goes to your bladder. So because it goes to your bladder, where are you going to find it? It's going to be in your urine, right? It's going to be in your urine. So look for the ova in the urine for Schistosoma hematobium. Look for the ova in your GI tract, in your stool, right? For Schistosoma mansoni or japonicum. Right? And again, your eosinophils are going to be high, right? You can also do serologies. And how do we manage this? You're going to give praziquantel, right? You're going to give praziquantel. You're going to give praziquantel, okay? You're going to give praziquantel on your exams, right? So again, another disease I'll just talk about really briefly, right? Don't forget chikungunya, right? Chikungunya. Chikungunya. Chi, C-H-I. Kun, K-U-N. Gunya, G-U-N-Y-A. Chikungun. Yeah, right? Remember, this is carried by the Aedes mosquito, right? It's carried by the Aedes mosquitoes, right? And those people are going to have, like, just very severe prolonged polyarthralgias, right? So many joints are going to hurt. And this is going to last for months. You're not going to get off the hook in like, a week. No, right? It's going to last for months, right? It's going to last for months, right? And many times, those people are going to have a fever. They're going to have a rash. They're going to have fever. They're going to have a rash. And there's no specific treatment. All you're going to do is NSAIDs. Right? Zika, right? Especially a person that travels to like Brazil or something like that on your exams, right? Think of Zika. Zika is also carried by the Aedes mosquito, right? And you can actually also get it sexually. Ooh, right? You can get it sexually, right? Or you can also be transferred from mom to the fetus, right? Vertical transmission, right? Again, the big thing you should worry about on your exams is congenital Zika syndrome, right? Congenital Zika syndrome, right? The kids will have a big head. They'll have They'll have microcephaly. Sorry, not a big head. They'll have a small head, microcephaly, right? They can have all these brain problems, vision problems, hearing problems, right? Vision problems, hearing problems. Although if they want to present a Zika to an adult, many times they will present it as Guillain-Barré. It can actually cause Guillain-Barré syndrome in adults on your exams, right? And the thing is, basically, if you're pregnant, you should not travel. If you're a woman that's pregnant, you really should not travel to an endemic area, a place that has a Zika. It may not be a very smart idea, right? And again, they can give you a question about a person that, you know, traveled to some foreign country, right? And then they did a lot of swimming, right? You know, they tell you that, ooh, I went whitewater rafting, right? So they went like rafting, or they went exploring caves, right? So again, it may not just be water exposure, although that's the classic thing. You can also get this from soil exposure, right? And then they tell you that the person has like very high fevers, headaches, myalgias, and then they use the term on your exams, conjunctival suffusion. Conjunctival suffusion. The person's eyes are red. When you see this, think of leptospirosis, right? Sometimes on your exams, instead of putting leptospirosis as the answer, they'll put spirochete as the answer, because leptospira is a spirochete, right? So just kind of keep that at the back of your mind. You see, I've been emphasizing things like flavivirus, picornavirus, single-stranded DNA virus. Again, keep these things at the back of your mind for your exams, right? And you see, I'm emphasizing the mosquitoes because they do test these things on the exams, right? So I talked about the Aedes mosquito, right? I talked about the Aedes mosquito for chikungunya, talked about it for Zika virus, right? Again, please make sure you know these things for your exams, right? Make sure you know these things for your exams, right? So again, if you come in contact with water, contaminated water, or contaminated soil, right? That's been contaminated by animal urine, right? Rats, cattle, that's why you can get this from soil, right? I don't think you're going to see cattle grazing in the water. That doesn't really make any sense, right? So that's how you can get it from soil, right? So keep that at the back of your mind for exams, right? Again, fever, headaches, myalgias, right? Conjunctival suffusion, S-U-F-F-U-S-I-O-N. Keep that at the back of your mind for exams, right? Think of leptospirosis, right? And the thing is, this can get really bad and it can form a thing known as a Wells disease, right? Wells disease, right? What happens in Wells disease? Basically, your liver and your kidneys and your lungs go up in flames. Your liver, your kidneys, and your lungs go up in flames. Your K and your L, right? Think of the alphabet, I, J, K, L, right? Your kidney and your two L's. Your kidney, your liver, and your lungs go up in flames, right? So they have like pulmonary hemorrhage, they have like jaundice, they have renal failure. When you see that, think of Wells disease. Wells disease. It's a very nasty complication of leptospirosis. Will is spelled W-E-I-L, and then apostrophe S, right? Wells disease. You know, if you go to Cornell for your med school, you should hopefully never get this wrong on your exams, right? I guess Cornell, the Will Cornell Medical School, it's a double L instead of well, but different discussion. All right, right. So keep that at the back of your mind for exams. And how do we manage this? We're going to manage this with doxycycline, right? If a person has just like the basic conjunctival suffusion, fevers, headaches, just give them a tetracycline like doxycycline, they're going to be fine. But if they have very severe disease, they are beginning to have like renal involvement, kidney, renal involvement, liver involvement, lung involvement, those people are going to need IV ceftriaxone or IV penicillin. IV ceftriaxone or IV penicillin, right? And then, what if they give you a question about a person that, again, traveled, right? Traveled, and the person, you know, went on the beach a lot, or they played with a lot of dogs or cats, and then they have like this intensely pruritic rash, you know, serpiginous rash on the skin, right? And you can even see like these tracks on the feet, especially on the feet of the buttocks, right? These tracks on the feet on the buttocks, especially in a person that walked bare feet. Then you want to think about a person that has cutaneous larva migrants, right? Cutaneous larva migrants, right? So you pretty much have a worm infection. And many times your eosinophil count will be elevated, right? So this is something from like the dog or the cat hookworm, you know? So like dogs or cats, you play with them, right? And the hookworms literally hook into you, right? Or you walk bare feet on the beach. These are all classic ways these kind of show up on the exams, right? Again, it's going to be from this bug. You may see the bug on your exams, Ancylostoma. Ancylostoma, A-N-C-Y-L-O-S-T-O-M-A, Ancylostoma, right? It kind of penetrates the skin. That's why you see this intensely pruritic, you know, serpiginous rash. You can even see like literally the worm literally tracking through your skin, right? How do you treat this on your exams? We're going to treat it with ivermectin or albendazole. Okay, you're gonna throw ivermectin or mebendazole on your exams, right? Ivermectin or albendazole, right? Just use your bendazole. Speak a bendazole answer or ivermectin on your exams. All right. So now, just to kind of wrap things up, I just want to give a few quick hits again that should help you think of certain associations on your exams, right? So again, if you see sub-Saharan Africa, right, like Nigeria, which is where I'm from, Nigeria, Togo, Chad, Ghana. Places like that, on, you know, Benin Republic on your exams, you want to think of things like malaria, think of yellow fever, think of schistosomiasis, right? Keep that in mind for your exams, right? You see a person going to like Southeast Asia, right? Think of things like Japanese encephalitis, especially like rural areas, right? Think of typhoid fever, think of leptospirosis, right? Think of dengue. Dengue is not only in African countries, right? Just keep that in mind. Even malaria, right? In fact, let me tell you this, guys. If you see fever in a returning traveler, fever and anemia in a returning traveler, that's malaria until proven otherwise. That's literally malaria until proven otherwise, right? And then if you see, South America, right? If you see South America, again, think of yellow fever. People can get yellow fever from South America. Yellow fever, people can get malaria, they can get dengue, right? You see a person that visits South America and then they develop heart failure after, he's like, I come back from South America, I have heart failure. I come back from South America, I have esophageal problems, right? That's Chagas disease from Trypanosoma cruzii, right? Keep that in mind for your exams. You see the Middle East, especially on your exams, think of schistosomiasis. Think of schistosomiasis. If you see a lot of eosinophils, right? Think of a parasite, right? Think of schistosomiasis. Think of the hookworm infection, right? If you see thrombocytopenia in a person that is a returning traveler, thrombocytopenia. Again, think of dengue. Think of dengue, right? If you see thrombocytopenia in a person that traveled within the US and they have like very severe headaches and all those things, you should think of rickettsia, actually. Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever. Just keep that in mind. A person that traveled to like North Carolina or something crazy. Think of Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever, right? So, and then what if you see jaundice in a traveler, right? Again, think of Hep A, viral hepatitis. Think of yellow fever, right? Think of leptospirosis, especially when it's gone to the Wells disease phase, or malaria, right? Malaria is going to cause an indirect hyperbilirubinemia because it literally infects your red blood cells and causes hemolysis. Whenever you have hemolysis, you're going to have an increase in your indirect bilirubin, right? And then if you see a lot of hemorrhage, a lot of bleeding, right? Think of yellow fever, think of dengue. There's a reason why dengue is literally called dengue hemorrhagic fever, right? Or also, you see a person that has like Ebola, you know, a person that travels to like some African country and they like have like DIC, multi-organ dysfunction. Think of like Ebola, think of Lassa fever in those circumstances, right? In fact, what is one amazing way our friends at the MBMS can try to mess you up? Oof. Oh my goodness. The MBMS, they're not stupid. There is, let me tell you this. It is amazing the kinds of questions they can create. It's literally amazing the kinds of questions they can create. Do you know what they can do to you on an exam? They can give you a question about a person that works at a morgue. Whew. A person, you know, they'll tell you that a patient traveled to some African country, right? Or some foreign country. It's probably going to be an African country, came back and died, right? And then they were sent to the morgue. And then they tell you that one of the morticians, right? Or one of the people that work at like a funeral parlor, funeral parlor or whatever. They tell you that this person, you know, has been having like nosebleeds, bleeding from the ears, thrombocytopenia, and all those things. You want to think about Ebola, right? Remember, Ebola, it's not only you that has the Ebola that can get in trouble. You can also get Ebola from handling a dead body of a person that had Ebola, right? So that's why if you're a person that works at a morgue or a person that works in a funeral home, you got to be careful. Right? See, let me tell you this. Even if you handle the cremated remains of a person that had Ebola, you can get Ebola that way. So if you handle the cremains, so it's called cremains, C-R-E-M-A-I-N-S, cremains of a person that has Ebola, that can absolutely be a USMLE question. You can get Ebola. All right. So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. I think I've really hammered travel medicine pretty hard, right? So you should know these things for your test, right? You should know these things for your test. And again, if you love the way I teach, you're going to love my classes. Right? And my classes, I'm the only one that teaches them. I don't like subcontract it to some person, right? I have classes for step one all the way to step three, level one all the way to level three. They start next week, actually, right? So I have a class on Monday. It's a 2.5 hour test taking class for step one to three. 2.5 hour class for step one to three. On Tuesday, I have a biostatistics class. also for step 1, 2, 3, it's a 4-hour class. On Wednesday, I have a social sciences and ethics review. It's a 5-hour class, also for step 1 to step 3. And then also, I have a last-minute review, but that's for step 2 and step 3 specifically. I have a last-minute review, that's for step 2 and step 3 specifically. I have a 20-hour class, that's for step 2 and step 3 specifically. Again, it's coming up within the next week or two here, right? So if you're taking any of those exams, again, many people have taken these exams and found these classes to be extremely helpful. I get so many reports, like literally, and this is not like a report from 5 years ago. No, I literally have reports from people that took the exams like within the last like month, took my classes and they got like very high scores. Very high scores. By very high scores, I mean things like 250s, 260s, 270s, right? I've actually had I think I've had like two 280s from my classes, I think, right? I think I have to go and check, right? But it's something, these classes, if you like the way I teach, you like the way I explain pathophys, you're going to love my classes, right? I have a 25-hour step 1 class coming up within the next few weeks as well. And then I have a 50-hour class for step 2, step 3. That's taking place in the middle of this year, the first 2 weeks in the month of June. That one has very, very limited spots available. So if you're interested, shoot me an email. I can give you some more information. All these classes are over Zoom, right? And it's me teaching them. Again, I do a lot of integration, pathophysiology. You're going to love these classes. I also offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE and Comlex exams, med school exams, residency exams. I offer tutoring for those. And then I have this podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify. And then I also have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos, that you can check out. And then another thing, you know, also another website I have is divineinterventionlifelessons.com. DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. Many of you that listen to my podcast, you know I'm a Christ follower. I do have a, you know, every week I make like one or two podcasts where from a biblical perspective, I address a life lesson. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that. There's almost like 400 episodes on there. Many people listen to those and find those to be very helpful. And then I also help with ERAS applications, mock interviews, personal statements, and things of that nature. So thank you for joining me in today's class. Again, I hope you found this, I hope you found this podcast to be very helpful. But again, I promise you, travel medicine A, travel medicine B, super high yield stuff to know for your exams. There's just so many ways. There's probably like 100 different vignettes they can generate from these two podcasts, right? So just make sure you listen to these very high yield. Most of the time, these are things that you either know or you don't know. So if you don't know, you're going to for sure get the question wrong. If you know, you're going to for sure get the question right. So many times it's not things you can necessarily reason out. So just keep that in mind and share this with your friends. So thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day. I'll see you in episode 633. God bless you and bye for now. Thank you.